Accession number 26561, real one.
Wing Commander David Bernard, real one. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Wing Commander?
Yes, I was born in Liverpool, just within sight of the cathedral, on the 23rd of May, 1920.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background?
Yes, my father was a naval and merchant captain, master mariner, and he died when I was nine. He had a job. He was a commander in the Royal Navy and went across to Chile to form their navy, and they gave him an acting rank of admiral to, you know, from commander to admiral, yes, just to give them the presence in Chile.
How did your family manage? How did your mother manage, what's the point?
When I died.
When he died,
yes. Well, she didn't do very well, really. She, the estate was not a wealthy one, and she left me with her brother, who for several years looked after me, and she'd come and visit me, and then she married her bank manager, and he looked after me after that.
And were you living in Liverpool all this time?
No. When my father, before he died, he was going to go off to Australia, and we were all packed up with trunks and everything to go to Australia. And he did a lot of journalism. For example, he was the first one to interview Loggy Baird for the television, and I've got a picture of him and Loggy Baird watching the first television. He also wrote books. He wrote a book on why the airship would never work. Interesting things like that. But I was nine when he died, and we were living in Wembley at that time.
So you moved
it? We moved from Liverpool on our way to Australia, and we got as far as Euston, and my father had this wonderful offer from the, I think it was the Sunday... Sunday Standard or some funny name for a Sunday paper. I can't remember what it was exactly. And he got such a good offer that he decided we wouldn't go on to Australia. We had tickets and passports and everything, trunks with all the stuff in, everything.
You stayed in London?
So we stayed in London, and we lived for quite a time in Euston Hotel. And then he bought a house on the outskirts of Wembley, when it was all countryside.
Now, where did your father... You went to your father's brother, your uncle?
No, it was my mother's... My mother's brother, James.
And yes. Where did he live?
He lived in Liverpool, so we went back there, you see. And my stepfather-to-be was a bank manager in Liverpool, and we lived out at Crosby, and he sent me to a good prep school.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, how did your education... You seem to be moving about a bit.
I had a lot of different schools. Infant schools in Sefton Park, Liverpool. And Victoria School in the outskirts of Liverpool. And then we went to... And to, what was it, Watford, and I went to a school there. And then we moved to Wembley, and I went to a school there. So I really got mucked about, and to my stepfather, who was very strict, but I admire him enormously. He did a lot for me. He was a World War I aviator instructor at Northolt, of all places. And... he sent me to a good school.
Which one?
A good prep school in Hoylake, near in the Wirral.
And how did your school go from then?
Oh, I went to Caldergrange Grammar School from then.
Now, how did you do at school once you'd settled?
reasonably well. I was a sort of middle, but took me a long time. My stepfather arranged for private tuition to get me into to get into the grammar school, which was paid for in those days. And from then on, I came out of the grammar school.
Now, what subjects did you specialise at, if you see what I mean? What subjects were you good at or liked? They're not always the same.
Geography, history, but science in particular.
Well, you can see why I'm angry towards this. Well, I mean, did you have an early interest in science?
Yes, very much so. Even at the infant school, I was reading a physics book when I can first read, and I took a deep interest in all things scientific.
And why? What put you that way? I mean,
the book I've read, I think. Yes.
So it's not something particular from the family or anything, it's just...
Not really, no.
You got interested early?
Yes.
Was there any particular branch of science that attracted you at first, or was it general?
General, chemistry and physics. But then I started, when I was 9, I built my first radio in 1929, yes.
Now, tell me, why radios?
It just intrigued me. I saw an article in the Boy's Own paper, which was a good boys' magazine at the time.
Now, I know it seems, how did you build it in 1929? What was that? Was this a
cat's whisker? It was a crystal set. I made my own cat's whisker and... I got a Geranek crystal and put that in. And the tuning was very primitive. It was a ping-pong bat which had slots cut in it and a mat sort of woven round it as a coil, two flat coils, and you merely tuned it in by turning the handle of the ping-pong bat.
And it worked?
And it worked, yes.
And did you build... bigger and better wireless?
Yes, I did.
Tell me how it progressed.
I went from there to... And then I think the local Dr. McAfee gave me a proper crystal set, and that interested me. And then I went on to thermionic valves. Incidentally, my real father, bought us a radio which sat on the dining table... with there were bright emitter valves, which are quite intriguing.
That helped, and you've got pretty good reception from the later ones you built.
Oh yes, I think the classic one was, I went and built a superhead, which is quite complicated in those days, and I put, because the cost of batteries was very expensive, the big HT battery was cost me all my pocket money, and the accumulator, which the battery for the heating the valves was quite easy because I could charge that myself. But to save the cost, I had a grip device, one of Mr. Terry's spring grip things and I put two contacts on that, and if I fell asleep in bed, I relaxed and switched it off that way. I was a great one for gimmicks in those days.
What would you listen to? In those days it was more, there was a sort of great hobby of wireless. I mean, people actually transmitting and all sorts of different. Tell me what you'd listen to.
Oh, just general music and mostly music, I think.
You didn't sort of listen to the wider bands, the shipping and all the rest of it?
No, I don't think whether that was in being or not available on my set. It was just the basic.
So it's just the BBC.
Yes. I also built on my bicycle. I had two bamboo poles sticking up with an aerial, and I had a spark transmitter on the back. And I'd cycle round, and my friend next door would receive me on his crystal set.
What, voice transmission?
No, not voice. Yes, spark was key. Morse code.
Did you learn Morse?
Yes.
But, I mean, did it take you long?
I wasn't very proficient. It wasn't until later that I went on proper training for...
So you weren't on any particular number of words per minute?
Interested in a radio, yes. And I could cycle around with this on my bicycle on the pannier at the back and transmit. And fortunately, it had a very broad band, and my stepfather complained bitterly that I was blotting out his enjoyment of his radio.
Now, when you were at school, I mean, did you have any particular interest in sport?
Oh, yes.
What about that?
I was very keen on swimming. That was my prime fun. And then when I went to the grammar school, I took up rugby, and I finished up being captain of rugby at school and captain of swimming at both the school and the local swimming baths. And I got cups for that.
So you were pretty good.
And I got my silver life-saving medal and all the other things like that. I was an instructor's certificate, the whole lot, yes.
But not cricket and football so much?
No, I was very anti-cricket because it bit into my swimming activities, and I couldn't say it was very athletic.
Was there a cadet force or of any sort?
Yes, and the grammar school was very good. It was an OTC, which wasn't called an OTC, because it was a bit anti-military at the time. But everything that happened in an OTC happened, and they called themselves the New O'Chaldeans. The headmaster was an ex-major from the World War I, and he was very keen on all these sort of things. And we learned all sorts of things like surveying, engineering, taking motorbikes to bits, and all sorts of things such as those. And swimming, he was very keen.
What about with this unofficial OTC,
Neo-Caldeans, it was Caldy Grammar School, yes. But, you know, he ran it, and most of the masters were
was
ex.
Was it drill and rifle drill?
Not a lot. Some shooting, of course.
But, .22?
Yes, and air guns as well.
And were you keen on this?
I enjoyed it very much, yes.
Was it compulsory or...?
No, it was optional. And we'd go and camp under canvas and that sort of thing. And I was a camp bugler for waking them up in the morning and so on. I was always interested in music.
Tell us about that, your musical interest.
Yes, I think I... Sir Malcolm Sargent used to give a series of lectures down in Wembley. And I went to all of those and with great enthusiasm, and I learned to play the violin. But when my stepfather took over, he couldn't stand the noise and forced me to sell it. but I still had a good background in music, thanks to Sir Malcolm Sargent, who would, I think it was something like sixpence a time to go to his lectures, which were excellent. Down in the local cinema.
Any other big hobbies? You know, Boy Scouts?
Yes, I was Boy Scout, those Cubs, all the whole...
Tell me what you did with the Boy Scouts.
Oh, we had all sorts of activities. We'd lay on pageants of Hiawatha and Crusaders, set up mammoth forts in the park and so on, and wigwams for the others. And we go camping, of course. And the school used to run runs up the mountains of Wales, North Wales, nearby. And we generally kept pretty fit through those activities.
It's a very busy, full of hobbies and sport and
busy time. Yes.
Now, how did you do at school in this? I mean, what were you going to do at the end of your school time?
Oh, go into engineering. My stepfather wanted me to go in the bank, and I said no, I couldn't stand that.
So how old were you when you left school?
17.
So you'd done your school certificate?
Yes, the matriculation certificate, yes.
So So what, when did that be? 1937.
Hmm.
And where did you go to tell us how you got a job in engineering?
Well, I went around and I got a studentship with the Automatic Telephone Company in Liverpool.
A studentship, is that like an apprenticeship?
It's an advanced apprenticeship. They also attended lectures at Liverpool University, and I went to the technical college. I worked very hard over that period. I would, for instance, living in the Wirral, and then I'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, catch a train down to the ferry, cross the river, get on a tram, and go several miles out to the Automatic Telephone Company, who gave me a very good background in,
now what were,
in it.
It's fairly obvious from the name, but could you describe a bit about the work you did with the firm?
Yes, I went through all their various departments, session in the drawing office, a long one there.
What were they doing in the drawing office?
All sorts of parts and circuitry and so on to do with telephones.
And exchanges?
And then, and what?
And exchanges.
Exchanges, yes. All automatic. And I also worked on various developments. And the Queen Bee, which is a radio... When I'd finished my one-year studentship, I was given a job in the inspection department, or development stroke inspection department. And there I was working on all sorts of Air Ministry orders that for microphones, headphones, Morse keys, bomb release gear. I worked
now on. Tell us about as many of these as you can remember, as much detail as you can. We're very interested in these things. I mean, I don't know which one you want to start with. The Queen Bee? I mean,
the Queen Bee was the most intriguing one of the lot. That was the latter one. In the early days, I worked on the development of the fusing unit, which is a little box that holds a wire which is holding the safety pin in the nose of the bomb. And if that pulls, it retains that wire connecting rod when the bomb falls away. But if that doesn't happen, the bomb goes, and the bomb is accidentally released, the pin doesn't come out, you see, in theory. And the release mechanism, which has got two safety devices in it, and the distributor. You obviously, if you're releasing a collection of bombs, you can't do this simultaneously because of the surge. But yes, there was a thing called, we called it the Mickey Mouse. It sequentially ticked round and triggered off all the release mechanisms in turn. We worked on a device for testing the microphones for aircraft. They hadn't got to be too sensitive, and they hadn't got to be too insensitive.
Now, what do you mean by that? Can you explain that a bit more?
Yes. If you're in an aircraft, you want to be able to hear wireless, which is a very weak signal. At the same time, you didn't want the tiny noises of the engine picked up, so it was a fairly selective portion of the noise band. And this device was very, very cleverly done. One of the big engineers, Dan, and I helped him develop this. We had a selenium cell. These microphones were fed down into a chute in front of an oscillating device, a loudspeaker, and with the band of frequencies that you wanted. And according to, it would then have a light on a galvanometer, which had a beam which went around a bank of selenium cells, and depending on which cell it landed on, that switched the Hornby-like railway that shot it down into a container for that selection. And we're very pleased with that. It was very, very exact and very, very good way of testing, which is cumbersome. In the old days, they'd have two men in kiosks and talk to each other, and it's not on.
Anything else? These are...
Yes, I was taking all my... I was down at the technical college at the time. Liverpool University lectures pertaining to electricity and so on. And the Liverpool Tech are in the city itself, at the back of the museum in Liverpool. And I got all my city and guilds, I got a whole bunch of them. Tech, engineering drawing, telephony, 1, 2, and 3, transmission and lines, 1 and 2, and then radio 1. And I took my finals in the RAF, in the prisoner of war camp.
Well, we'll certainly come to that. So, you'd started all these qualifications before the war.
Oh, yes. I was working on that and became enthusiastically expert.
Now, the Queen Bee business, had that started before the war broke out?
Oh, yes.
In 1937
it started out. It was the aeroplane itself was... I've got a picture of it on...
They can't see it, I'm sorry.
No. It was a biplane, a Tiger Moth. And it was controlled by radio devices. And because it was pneumatically driven, Sperry autopilot, which was driven by wind, and we used post office relays, and instead of bunches of contacts from these relays, there was a little rod going into a slide valve to conduct the airflow pneumatic circuit into whatever was required to control the aeroplane.
Sounds complex.
Yeah, and it was data, by the way. Digital. It was pulsed, you see. And we couldn't tolerate an analogue one, otherwise the aircraft would have been doing this as they...
This is a full-size Tiger Moth, or a model?
No, a full-size one.
That's right. Was it entirely wireless controlled, or...?
It had a position for the pilot to sit in, and a lot of the controls were post office pieces, because they were reliable, and you got positive action from them, and they were digital. For instance, when the pilot took the aeroplane up to test it and see if it was behaving properly in the development of this radio control, he had a giant, because he was gloved, he had a giant post office dial, and he had to put his gloved finger into that and dial the various actions that he required. And the control box on the ground was about that big.
About 3 foot. 2 foot 6
high, and about 18 inches square at the top, sloping type, with all well-proven electrical devices that the post office used. And I had an old bugle maker who used to do all the pneumatic valves for me, you know, that slid off the armature of the relay.
And this all actually worked?
It worked beautifully, yes.
So what sort of manoeuvre could you carry out? I mean...
Oh, turn and bank and direction and so on, yes.
Anything more fancy, aerobatic?
Not really, no.
It was but basic flying?
Yes.
What about landing?
Yes, it could.
Did you ever try it?
No. It was in the development stage, you realise. So they were going places. There were no model aeroplane with radios or anything in them those days.
So, I mean, that sounds pretty secret work.
Yes, I was committed to secrecy, yes.
And all these projects are under the auspices of the Air Ministry? That's right.
In fact, I was given an Air Ministry, it was called an AID stamp, which I could stamp things that had been tested by me. If I did a sample testing, I would put my stamp on it.
Now, anything else about this period?
I think the other interesting one, backtracking a little, is my stepfather, having been a pilot, instructor, was very keen for me. I thought at the time he might want to get rid of me, but Alan Cobham, who became Sir Alan Cobham, had an air circus which used to travel around. And I think it was a de Havilland 7C or something like that, a biplane. And my stepfather said, you know, I'll pay for you to go up for a free ride in this. This was in the Wirral and Hendon. Heswell. And Sir Alan, he was then Alan Cobham, took me up and he handed me two giant toilet rolls, the kind that are in Tesco's. And he said, when I give you the word, he said, throw them at one of those side, and I'll do this. No intercom, of course, but I give you a thumbs up. Throw that over the side. And I, a little perplexed, why do you want to throw toilet rolls, giant toilet rolls over? And I did this. And this was my first flight in an aeroplane, by the way. And he then commenced to loop and dive and churn around, chopping this vase, which streamed out instantly. And chopped it into little pieces. I was a bit reluctant to throw the second one out.
Did you enjoy that flight, though?
Oh, yes.
You weren't airsick?
Yeah. No. And I had it was all flapping canvas round you. And it had a thing called a monkey chain, which you had a harness and you had a clip, sort of a little miniature dog lead, which clipped to the strut in the base of the cockpit.
To keep you in?
To stop you falling out when he looped it.
But it didn't frighten you? I mean, you're
no,
a bit...
No,
you
know, no. No, I'd be, 14, 15, 16, 15 at the time.
Did you get any other... flights, or was that a one-off?
That was a one-off, yes.
Do you know what year that was that he did that?
Yes, that'd be, if I was 15, it'd be...
1935.
35, yeah.